You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Thomas Tokuingawa, no mai hari mai ki te waia mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahine Monday. I'm your host Thomas and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by News Director Castor. E whai ake nei, coming up on the show, I talk to University of Auckland Professor of Nursing, Andrew Joel, about understaffing in nursing and how it is leading to burnout. And I also spoke to Chief Executive for the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation New Zealand, Letitia Harding, about new global care for children with asthma based on New Zealand research. Castor, what do you have for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party Simon Court, I asked about the ACT Party's new health policy focused on increasing the responsibilities of pharmacists and about the government's decision to scrap the Broadcasting Standards Authority. I also spoke to President of Te Aka Tauira, the Victoria University of Wellington Students Association, Aidan Donoghue, about the fees-free program in light of proposals to cut it from the next budget. And I spoke to National Secretary of the Tertiary Education Union, Amy Ross, also about the fees-free program.
He aha o whakaaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or waia mā rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e wareware e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kore anō, he pakehere roki mā runga i te pai, Tukutuko e iri rangi poho me hariki 95BFM e rakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get on with the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, the ACT Party announced a new health policy that would see the responsibilities of pharmacists expanded to move pressure away from GPs. The idea of the policy is that for less significant health issues, people could see their local pharmacist instead of their GP, reducing wait times and costs for the general public. Also last week, the government announced plans to scrap the Broadcasting Standards Authority. The announcement follows a period of complaints from the government over the BSA, which had ruled on online broadcaster The Platform. The government and The Platform said that the BSA shouldn't be able to make rulings on online broadcasters, but many others disagree. Without the BSA, many of the restrictions and rules that broadcasters are held to could disappear. In addition, the BSA offers a vehicle for members of the public to hold said organisations to account. Without the BSA, avenues for public feedback on poor conduct are minimal. For this week's catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court, I asked about each of these issues, beginning with the party's new health policy. I want to start off with ACT's health policy announcement last week regarding boosting the powers of pharmacists and letting them take some of the roles that have been traditionally held by GPs. What kind of expansions is ACT proposing?
Well, our policy makes healthcare easier to access because right now one of the biggest problems is that people can't get timely appointments to see a GP. They can eventually get to see a GP. Sometimes it's 2, 3, 4 days after they place a phone call and they're told, yes, you can have an appointment. But so if a trained pharmacist can safely treat an urgent everyday condition or renew routine medication or otherwise see somebody, triage them in the same way as a nurse might at a GP clinic, so they can refer them on to the right course of action, whether back to the GP or, you know, goodness, maybe off to the emergency department. That's much better for the patient, and it's also better for the GPs, who can then focus on more complex cases.
Yeah, and I want to talk to that a little bit. I mean, I can't speak to every pharmacy across the country, but my local pharmacy and some of my friends' pharmacies as well are pretty small or have low staffing numbers. And so it looks like they could be struggling as we introduce these increased responsibilities on pharmacists. Are there going to be any funding boosts or infrastructure boosts to the pharmacies across our country to address this increase in demand?
Well, that's really interesting feedback that you've picked up. We're hearing other things, though, which is that using robots to dispense medicine in pharmacies means that pharmacists are no longer counting pills into containers. That's freed up a lot of their time to do more high-value tasks. And we already have pharmacists being able to prescribe basic medicines. Recent changes to the rules around what pharmacists could do mean that they can prescribe medications and treat people, say, for, you know, common things like scabies, for example, which means those people who may actually be infectious don't have to go into a GP clinic. But they also need urgent treatment because it's something that if it was to spread for a couple more days in your family home, could be disastrous. So, pharmacists are already highly trained. They have high-level degrees and qualifications. They're used to seeing people presenting with all kinds of conditions, searching for medicine in the pharmacy. They're ready to do it, and I understand that they have the time as well as the capacity. And of course, you know, the modern day community pharmacy is competing with big chains in the malls. And you know, in the past, they used to supplement their income by selling shampoos and lipsticks and all kinds of things. But a lot of that trade is actually being captured by the larger chain stores. So I think it's important, and you know, ACT believes it's really important, that the pharmacists who we've invested so much in their training, who are skilled medical practitioners in their communities, are given the opportunity to actually add a bit more value into the system and make the medical system more productive.
Yeah, and there's two key issues that a lot of people have noted with or around GPs at the moment, which are, as you mentioned, wait times, but also the cost, right? Some GPs are costing people as much as like $80, $100 per appointment. How would this policy go towards addressing GP costs, especially as compared to Labor's announced policy of 3 free GP visits a year?
Well, what an interesting contrast. I mean, it can cost anywhere between, say, $45 up to maybe $90 or even $100 if you need to see a GP and it's urgent. Whereas we envisage many of these services being delivered at around the $40 mark. And when you consider what ACT is proposing, making the most of the resource that's currently underutilized in the pharmacy so that more people can be seen for more common ailments, like getting prescription for a chest infection, for example. You can't wait 2 or 3 days to see a doctor. It might actually get a lot worse in that time frame. So stopping people from needing to go to emergency department or needing high levels of care, ACT's supply side intervention, you know, which for people who don't study economics means you focus on increasing the supply and availability of services, as opposed to Labor's demand side solution, which is essentially doesn't add a single more doctor, a single more GP, just increases the number of people who have 3 free visits, and probably the outcome of that is longer waiting times to see a GP, because people, instead of actually being able to get a low cost, quick turnaround, say from a pharmacy under X policy, are going to just add to the queues of people waiting to get into their local GP. So, you know, ACT focuses on the supply side, labour, and all of their policies. You know, when they were in government as well, seems to focus on increasing demand without even considering whether the supply of professionals is available to deliver the service.
Next, I want to talk about the Broadcasting Standards Authority. The government's announced plans to scrap it, get rid of it entirely. My first question, I guess, about the BSA is, why should members of the public care about getting rid of it? I mean, aren't there bigger issues for the government to be dealing with at the moment?
Well, it's because the BSA was wading in on internet channels when it comes to matters of what they consider taste and appropriate language, where the jokes are funny. I mean, this is an entity set up in the 1980s where there were very few TV and radio channels in New Zealand. Most of them were state-owned. That world doesn't even exist anymore. You can get your content from anywhere, podcasts, you know, live streams, YouTube, socials, you know, on-demand. And the current rules treat similar content differently depending on where it originates, whether it's on a broadcast television set or whether it comes to you on a small screen or a tablet. And so it's completely out of date. We do not need a taste and comedy police, a state agency to police those things. But when it comes to real harms, things like defamation, incitement, you know, breaching suppression orders, maintaining people's privacies, there are already laws around that, and those laws should continue to be enforced. So when you're asking about the government's priorities, our priority is to reduce waste and to reduce the interference of government and people's lives. That is one of the reasons ACT exists. So getting rid of the BSA lines up with that. In fact, so aligned that the government has actually taken on much of Laura McClure, ACT MP's members bill, which also proposed to get rid of the BSA. So it's perfectly aligned to where this coalition government is going.
One of the big things you've mentioned, and one of the big things the government has mentioned as well in these plans to scrap the BSA, is how it's been affecting internet broadcasters. I want to get into that a little bit, because the government's been making out that this is targeting, you know, regular broadcasts. It could go on to target social media posts, that sort of thing. In its current state, the BSA has only targeted internet broadcasters that are acting as, you know, internet-only radio stations. Is this not within the BSA's purview?
Well, the BSA seemed to think it was, but ACT's proposal is we don't need the BSA at all. We do not need a taste and content moderator. We do not need some state bureaucrats telling whether it's a TV station or an internet station whether their jokes are funny and whether they're in good taste or not. I mean, the BSA sought to investigate the platform because Sean Plunkett said the word mumbo jumbo. Now, what on earth is a state agency investigating a broadcaster, whether they're on the internet or the radio, for saying the word mumbo jumbo? It's ridiculous. So they can go and they won't be missed.
I think the important thing here, Simon, though, is that the BSA is dealing with these cases around when people say harmful language, racist, misogynist, homophobic rhetoric, and also when people say things that are just plainly inaccurate, right? The BSA just recently dealt with a one news headline, I believe, that was talking about Donald Trump and was giving misrepresentation of a quote. You know, the BSA provides a very valuable service to members of the public in ensuring that our broadcasters do keep to this higher standard. What do we have if it's gone?
Well, look, I'll reiterate. It's illegal to defame people, to incite people to violence, to violate suppression orders, or breach people's privacy. There are already laws around that, and those laws need to be enforced. When it comes to what people consider misinformation, I mean, of course you wouldn't watch the New Zealand state broadcaster radio or TVNZ or Radio New Zealand if you wanted to find out what was really happening in the world. You'd have to go and search a number of other sources to get some balance, because you're not going to get it from the state broadcaster. And so whether the BSA can tell you that or not, I tell you what, the viewers are choosing different channels, because we know that from the success of alternative internet-based broadcasters like The Platform, or of independent privately owned media like ZB, the ZB Network, and many others around the world. So look, we don't need the BSA to tell us, you know, when some journalist or some news headline is rubbish. We can find that out for ourselves, usually within seconds.
And lastly on that, I want to address what you said about the phrase mumbo jumbo. You represented it as if it was something that Sean Plunkett was saying, devoid of context. He was talking particularly about, I believe, Māori tikanga and te ao Māori values. Is that not... I mean, that's something that someone shouldn't be saying on radio. You know, that seems quite offensive, that seems quite derogatory, and it's rejecting something that is crucial to our identity as a nation. The BSA exists to cover things like this, and it has existed, and as a radio station at BFM, we're subject to it as well, and we acknowledge our obligations under that requirement. Is this not just going to make radio a wild west, almost, of people being able to say whatever they want with no consequence?
Well, you know, my favourite BFM ad is fuck knuckles, cock and piss. So, you know, I mean, you can say just about anything on the radio and offend someone. If you're concerned about whether someone like Sean Plunkett disagrees with the proliferation and use of tikanga in broadcasting and government, for example, that's a debatable point. I mean, you raised the issue that it's part of New Zealand's identity. Well, it is part of some people's cultural identity, but for many New Zealanders, it's not. And it's not for the BSA to call out whether Sean's political views or whether anyone's political views shared on the media are within the boundaries of good taste or acceptable content. That's up to the people listening or viewing whether they want to watch that. They can switch. But, of course, we have laws about incitement. We have laws about breaching people's privacy and so on, and they need to be enforced and maintained. ACT will always support that. But getting rid of the BSA is a no-brainer.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about the ACT Party's new health policy and scrapping the Broadcasting Standards Authority.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
We'll be back after a short break. This is Good Day Today by David Lynch.
Thank you. The world-famous True School Hip-Hop Show.
Thursday nights, take a deep dive into all things hip-hop with BFM's True School, checking in on current and historical flows, beats, and grooves, both local and international. A Radio B institution spanning decades of solid cuts, and the one show to know.
We like the breeze, float straight out of our lids.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Keeping you clued in on what's fronting in the world of hip-hop.
True School Hip-Hop Show.
Who you calling a bitch?
Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. with Get Ban, Luz, Max, Barry, and Eve Love in the area.
On 95 BFM.
Celebrate NZ Music Month with Mighty.
The teeny tiny venue featuring acoustic sets from some of your fave Kiwi artists, including Leao,
Geneva AM,
John Tugood,
Don McGlashan,
Reb Fountain,
Liz from the Beths,
and heaps more.
Mighty in Te Komititanga, May 5th till the 17th.
Free, no booking required.
Mighty is made possible by Auckland Live Interesting Things and Auckland Council Events. Find out more at aucklandlive.co.nz.
B-card holders, we've got yet another treat for you lucky ducks. We're giving away copies of Muna's stellar new record, Dancing on the Wall. Just listen to 95 BFM Drive all week and await your cue to enter. Dancing on the Wall, the new album by Muna, out now and available wherever good music is found.
Crisp biscuits and fresh vegetables every Tuesday from 7 p.m. Replayed 4 a.m. Wednesday and always online at 95bfm.com. Check it.
Stinky Jim. He stinks from within.
Koe anake ki te waka ki te moana. Kaore kau e matangi. Kaore he ahane. Titiro mai, titiro mai. Te ama ka tau ke atu nei hau atura ka mate au ki te moana marie ka Anana e,
affairs current?
Richard, great question.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That was O Artura by Marlon Williams.
Last week, NZ First leader Winston Peters linked that the government is planning to cut the fees-free program that would see university students not paying course fees during their last year of study. The plan was later confirmed by Finance Minister Nicola Willis. Many students and educators have expressed displeasure at the announcement. The original policy, fees-free for the first year of study, was changed by this government earlier in its term to affect the final year. At the time, the argument was that the change would motivate students to finish their degrees rather than just take the first year scot-free. Now, with the program set to go, it's unclear what the plan is from the government to do with the policy. To discuss the fees-free program meant for students and the financial benefits it presented, I spoke to President of Te Akotahira, the Victoria University of Wellington Students Association, Aidan Donoghue. We're talking about fees-free today. The government's recently announced a bit haphazardly that the fees-free program is going to be going. Starting out, I guess, at the start of fees-free, when it was announced for the first year of people going to university, what did that represent for students? What kind of opportunity did that provide?
Look, I think it represented a lot of hope for students who had been dealing with so many changes to the space over the course of decades when it came to how much you paid to go to university, you know, and you had interest-free loans and then we won interest-free loans. And then this was a sign that eventually education might be seen as a public good again, and it might be the start to a process that university might be free again like it was in the 20th century.
And thinking about the things that it did for students in particular, in terms of financial pressures, our students have struggles around, you know, finding jobs, particularly in today's job market. What kind of things did it do for people financially?
Look, I was one of the recipients of fees-free back when I started in 2022. And to be honest, it was actually a huge boon for me in making the decision to go to university within the country. It wasn't perfect, but I know myself and many others did actually factor it a lot in our decision-making to go to university. And, you know, you do obviously take out a lot of debt if you go on to postgraduate. That's even more if you need living costs, you don't qualify for student allowance. That's tens of thousands extra. So any alleviation, you know, of that to 12,000, you know, a third of your bachelor's degree, is honestly very welcome.
And there's been some criticisms of fees-free as a program. Some say that it doesn't provide enough money to students right now. The benefits that would be seen from fees-free actually are only seen very far down the line when students may have jobs anyway. What would you say to those criticisms? And if you agree, what would you say would do better than fees-free, for example?
Yeah, look, no, I understand those criticisms, and to be honest, they are valid, but at the end of the day, if the question is not having it versus having $12,000 off your debt, I'd take the $12,000 off my debt. However, in saying that, I've always been a proponent that, you know, one person can walk and chew gum at the same time. Two things can be true. So I see that we should reduce debt, but also look at how much money students have per week that they can actually interact and participate with society. They're not just funding their necessities, your power, your groceries and your rent, but you can actually go out and live. And, you know, with the cost of living, we've seen all those factors compound, fuel, power. It's all just really hitting hard for students. So if, you know, in an ideal world, I'd like to see both. I would like to see an increase to student allowance and living costs and, you know, and that be universalised, but also measures to reduce debt at the end of the road.
And there's a couple key year groups of students who have been, I guess, screwed over by this policy. From 2024 to 2026, anyone who started in these years would have missed out on the first year fees-free, but they're also going to miss out on the last year fees-free after that got moved by the government. This has been criticised by a good few people as unfair in certain ways by the government. What would you say to that, and what would you say about these students and their perspective, I guess, representing them to the government?
Yeah, look, I think it's an utter joke, to be honest. I think that, you know, to say that all those who didn't get anything in 24, 25, 26, those who started and are only finishing in 26 might be the only ones who get it. So anyone who's doing more than a three-year degree, so engineering, law, a double degree, a double major, anything, or you fail one course and you have to take another one the year after, you're going to miss out entirely. Our first and second years who made the informed choice that they'll come to university and, you know, with that entitlement being provided for, it's just the rug pull from our underneath them. And so at the very minimum, you'd expect to see, you know, a graduated removal of the relief. That way, those who did come with the promise will actually still receive it. But no, it's just a short, sharp shock right at the end of this year.
And if we're imagining for a moment, this is a bit of wishful thinking, the government hasn't confirmed what any of this money would go towards instead. If we're going to be optimistic on behalf of students, what would you like to see that funding going towards if it's not going towards fees-free, something else to support students?
Well, you know, it's hard to be optimistic and I wouldn't hold my breath. But look, one idea is to, for the exact same cost, you know, $12,000, is to give each student a yearly grant of $4,000 that they don't have to pay back. You know, they could choose to spend that on their fees if they don't really need it, you know, for their day-to-day living, or for those who are really struggling, could actually go a long way in supporting them.
And lastly, is there anything you'd like to say to the government about this policy, about this program and it being scrapped?
Look, I just don't know. I'm very confused, and I think many are so bewildered by this change because the logic, it doesn't really make sense to me. You know, if they really didn't like the policy, why did they not scrap it when they first came in and get rid of first year's fees free? Why go through all the effort to change it to final year's fees free, which you say yourself is an incentive for students to come and finish studying? You've put millions of dollars into supporting IRD, into administering the project, and then a year after it's implemented, you scrap it. If that's not wasteful spending, I don't know what is.
Next, to discuss the educator perspective on the announcement, I spoke to National Secretary of the Tertiary Education Union, Amy Ross, also about the fees-free program. To start us off on fees-free, I guess your perspective would be different from a lot of students coming from the educator's angle. What did fees-free represent for you and for the TU more broadly?
Well, it represented a step forwards into reducing the student debt and the burden on our students that we know undermines their ability to engage in education. It prevents a barrier to access, and it's simply a point of relief in what is a cost of living crisis, which we are all suffering from right now.
And from your perspective as an educator as well, do you think the financial burden on students plays, what kind of impact do you think it plays on their education?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, anyone with eyes can see that if you are struggling to make ends meet, it's hard to come to class prepared, it's hard to have enough food in your belly, it's hard if you're worrying about how you're going to pay the rent, it's hard if you're thinking, this course I'm in is representing future debt that I'm going to have to cut to carry. And when you put that alongside, you know, the gutting of pay equity, the potential for so many of our students is there going out into occupations which are being underpaid and now with more debt. I mean, it's crazy. It feels like this coalition government hates workers and hates students and basically hates New Zealanders.
And one of the big criticisms of fees-free has been that it doesn't affect students materially, I guess, while they're at university and only starts to give them benefits once they're out and earning money at their jobs anyway. Are you seeing students going out and getting into jobs after they get their degrees, or is it more troublesome, you know, as we see this unemployment crisis for everyone?
Yeah, and I think just scrapping fees-free because it wasn't delivering perfectly everything that it was intended to, we haven't asked why that is. Like, is it that actually we needed education to be free for not just 1 year? We need to seriously invest as a country in accessible, public, quality education and ensure that then the workers that come out of that are paid fairly and are able to give back to their community and be engaged in their communities. I think that's what we really want to see. We want to see a comprehensive policy package, not this kind of little bits and pieces. And this coalition seems to just demolish and take away and don't seem to have any aspiration for our country, any vision for the future and for what our students mean to this country going forward.
Yeah, and if you could speak to some of those points a little bit more, I mean, how would you view this policy and how would the TU view this policy in the broader government's approach to tertiary education?
Oh, I mean, it's completely consistent with their approach, which is to underinvest, undervalue and ignore effectively the amazing people who deliver the education and our amazing students and what they represent for the future of our country. They have continued to underfund so that not every student is actually a funded student. So that means larger class sizes, that means less pastoral support, less tutors, less support on the ground for our students per student. And they continue this punching down, which is, again, removing something which is investing in the future and reducing the burden of student debt. So now we know students in the future are going to carry more burden into their working life. And that is just catastrophic.
And when it was introduced, many people viewed fees free for the first year as sort of a first step going into introducing more policies that could support the government to invest further in tertiary education and support not only students but also educators as well. If we transport ourselves back to that time, I guess, what other policies would you like to see on top of fees free to support our tertiary education institutions to provide more for our students and for our educators as well?
We would like our tertiary sector to stop having to operate like a corporation and to be constantly talking about it in economic terms, because our education system is far much more than economics. It's about social good, it's about innovation, it's about creativity, it's about how we interrelate as a society and a community. And we don't seem to be talking about that ever. We're talking about it as if we're all widgets and numbers and productivity units. And if we stay in that playing field, we're never going to realise our full potential and recognise that it's an investment in our whole world and our future, the tertiary space. And if we have quality, accessible public education, then we can thrive as a society. We can solve our wicked problems. People can realise their full potential and have opportunities in this life, which we all want and we all deserve. But to do that, we need a comprehensive policy solution of fully funding our tertiary sector and recognising it and measuring it beyond economic productivity widgets, which are nonsensical and ignore the primary value.
Those were President of Te Ako Tauira, the Victoria University of Wellington Students Association, Aidan Donoghue, and National Secretary of the Tertiary Education Union, Amy Ross, both speaking to me about the announcement that the fees-free program for university students is set to be scrapped.
After years of hiring freezes, underfunding, and now cancelled pay equity claims, nurses' working conditions have continued to get worse, and now many are facing burnout, impacting them and their patients' well-being. Despite a clear need for more nurses, with 37% of all nursing shifts in public hospitals being understaffed, many newly graduated nurses are still struggling to find work, and those who do are more commonly being put on part-time contracts. With poverty and economic hardship increasing, emergency departments find themselves increasingly burdened and struggling to deliver quality care while under-resourced. To discuss the state of nursing in New Zealand and why it's leading to burnout, I talked to University of Auckland Professor of Nursing, Andrew Joel. Can you tell us about the current work conditions nurses are facing and how they're leading to burnout?
So, nurses are really stressed and really vexed. This government, whilst its words support nurses and are supportive of nurses, its actions are not. We know that despite what the government says, there are nursing shortages. We can see from the data from 2024 that more than half of all weekday nursing shifts are understaffed according to need. And that means that more and more care gets rationed. And as there is more and more missed care, then things like patient observations or just engagement with the patient diminishes, and that leads to failures in opportunities to capture patients before they deteriorate.
Talking about the understaffing there, it does really seem like the government is hesitant to try help. There's hundreds of new grad nurses who are struggling to get jobs, and when they do get them, they're often being given reduced part-time roles. And you mentioned in your article on the subject that the government essentially did a hiring freeze for nurses in 2024. How much of this issue is caused by the government itself?
Well, the government has imposed cuts on the delivery of healthcare. the natural target for any cuts is going to be staff, because staff costs are the largest component of healthcare delivery. And if you cut staff, then you cut care. And despite the government's promises about not diminishing frontline staff, we are actually understaffed.
And is it frustrating that, you know, it feels like nurses are understaffed when there might be new grads there to fill those roles?
Absolutely. And the new grads are living with a lot of uncertainty. They don't know whether they're going to get employed, in New Zealand. They don't know whether they're going to be employed full-time or not. And that level of uncertainty contributes to people going overseas. And when we are understaffed in our own country, why are we sending nurses overseas? It makes no sense at all.
And talking about those nurses who aren't being employed as full-time, the government's proposed the Employment Leave Bill, which will likely reduce sick leave entitlements for part-time workers. Does this just feel like another attack on nurses who are already struggling?
It's one of many attacks on nurses, and it's not just nurses, it's healthcare overall, but nurses are still are certainly feeling very vexed about this. I've had nurses communicating with me since the article was published who are saying, yes, you're telling our truth, and they feel very angry and they're just not able to deliver their best. And nobody gets into a job not wanting to deliver their best.
You talked about how there's multiple actions going against nurses. Another one of those bills is the new Equal Pay Amendment Act. Could the lack of recognition for nursing burnout and this continuous kind of attacks on nursing be partly due to it being a female-dominated profession?
Oh, I have no doubt about that. This strikes me as misogyny at play.
Are you seeing any impact on quality of preceptorship your students receive on placement due to the burnout of registered nurses working at hospitals?
Preceptorship certainly adds to the burden of registered staff in hospitals. The student nurses are supervised by our own staff as well, and I'd hope that they are getting the experiences that that is necessary and that the supervision that is required. But you know, I was talking to a manager of healthcare services not so long ago, and that person who manages a large number of services within a large hospital expects that normally there'd be one, maybe two services in trouble at any one point in time. But they said to me, all their services are in trouble right now. And that is an environment that is not conducive to good quality care, to safe patient care, or to a good working environment.
With, you know, the government's current actions and everything going on for nurses, what do you see for the future of nursing in New Zealand at the moment?
Well, I know that I and a number of other senior nurses around the country are very worried about the future of nursing. And we would like to see that more resources are focused on nursing. The government acts in a way that is congruent with their actual words. Not only just to say that they support nurses and that nurses are central to healthcare, but to act in ways that show support for nurses, that acknowledge that nursing is central to good healthcare delivery.
That was University of Auckland Professor of Nursing, Andrew Joel, speaking to me about nursing burnout and understaffing in New Zealand. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Flamingo by the Spectre Collection.
Lagoons for fun to mine the bones. Ah!
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. That was Bashful on the Sugar by Yumi Zuma. Last week, the Global Initiative for Asthma released an update on the recommended approach for treating asthma in children. The change now advises that children should follow the same treatment approach as adults, using a 2-in-1 anti-inflammatory reliever inhaler rather than the currently commonly used reliever-only inhaler. The announcement was based in part on findings from a study run by the Medical Research Institute of New Zealand, which found the change in treatment could reduce asthma attacks in children by an average of 45%. To discuss the potential impacts on the global treatment update and New Zealand's role in the change, I talked to the Chief Executive of the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation New Zealand, Letitia Harding. Can you start off explaining this new global update to asthma care that the Global Initiative for Asthma announced last week and how New Zealand research has supported it?
Yeah, so the GINA guidelines, which as you said is the Global Initiative for Asthma, they've been around for over 30 years. So they're the international guidelines on management for asthma. And for us, it's been a fantastic showcasing of New Zealand research because of the change to the guidelines specifically around therapy for children. The major change really came from findings from a care study which was run by the Medical Research Institute led by Professor Richard Beasley, which looked at using anti-inflammatory reliever therapy with a combined inhaler, which is the budesonide formoterol inhaler for children. And to see that actually included in these guidelines is fantastic.
And how big of an impact do you think this change in treatment could have on children with asthma around the world?
Yeah, look, it's going to be such a big difference. We know that with using this combined 2-in-1 inhaler, which has both the anti-inflammatory and reliever medications in them, it can actually reduce asthma attacks in children by almost 50% compared with the old sort of commonly used reliever-only inhaler. So it's a massive game changer. And, you know, for too long, many children with mild asthma have relied on just a reliever inhaler. So this is a much better way to try and prevent hospitalizations and actually save lives.
And with less of those hospitalizations and making treatment more straightforward and maybe easier to do long term, could this also take some pressure off hospitals?
Oh, definitely. Yes, without a doubt. I mean, there's no cure for asthma, so if we can manage it more effectively and we can prevent those hospitalizations, that creates a huge impact and reduces burden on the hospital system. And, you know, we are also coming up into winter, which can obviously, the cold season can be a trigger for asthma attacks, so it's really important that we do manage it well. A lot of people don't realise we still get almost 100 people dying every year from asthma, and it does affect 1 in 8 adults and 1 in 8 children, so it is a really common disease. And, you know, kids in New Zealand, they still are missing around, it's averaged out to be about 360,000 school days each year to asthma symptoms. So, you know, if we can manage this better, if we can prevent hospitalizations, then that's a huge positive impact.
How do you think that this is going to be implemented into the New Zealand healthcare system? Could there be any issues gaining funding for these inhalers for children?
Yeah, I think the important thing is that we, you know, people with children with asthma are actually going to their health professional and just having a bit of a warrant fitness check, checking that they are on the right medication, checking about asthma, the inhaler technique. That was another big change that was actually in this report, was talking about making sure that the inhaler technique for preschool for children is actually adhered to properly. And, you know, that comes down to this asthma management, and I think that's going to be really important for parents to talk to the health professional about, see what is funded, see what medication their child should be on. I mean, if we can prevent school days being lost and, you know, keep the kids in schools, stop parents having to take time off work as well, which is other costs associated with this, then that's a huge benefit.
And apart from those changes you mentioned there, is there anything else in the updates that's important for people with asthma in New Zealand?
Yeah, I think another good thing to see was just that advising parents and caregivers of children with asthma not to smoke or vape, you know, secondhand smoke or vaping around children. That is also in these guidelines, so that's a really important aspect.
And do you think, you know, seeing this New Zealand research used so prominently, is that going to be an encouragement for more asthma-based research to take place in New Zealand?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, we hope so, definitely. I mean, New Zealand really does punch above their weight when it comes to research, and we've got a lot of exciting research coming up in asthma and especially things like personalised medicine space. So it is fantastic to see that New Zealand research put into international guidelines, and hopefully we'll see more of it.
That was Chief Executive of the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation New Zealand, Letitia Harding, talking to me about an update to the recommended treatment of children's asthma and the New Zealand research that led to it.
That was The Wire.
Era te hau taka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki a maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahine Monday. Thank you for everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, Ti Aka Tawaera, the Victoria University of Wellington Student Association, Aidan Donoghue, National Secretary of the Tertiary Education Union, Amy Ross, University of Auckland Professor of Nursing, Andrew Joel, and Chief Executive of the Asthma and Respiratory Foundation New Zealand, Letitia Harding. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The Wonderful with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.